It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Get ready for Trump versus Biden. Round two. What's it like when politics divides your house? And what's the lasting influence of America First? A conversation with Kellyanne Conway. It's the Will Cain podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? Welcome to Monday. Welcome to a new week. I hope you will share this podcast with your friends. Download, rate, and review wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. You can watch the Will Cain podcast on YouTube. Today, a surprising conversation. As you'll hear me lay out in the beginning, I met Kellyanne Conway in a green room at Fox News a few short weeks ago. Before that, Kellyanne Conway was a character, maybe a caricature in my mind, one painted by the mainstream media. It didn't take long in that green room for Kellyanne Conway, not purposefully, but certainly, change my impression of the caricature. She is direct. She is intelligent. And she is unflappable. She is confident and someone who is there to share with you exactly the way she sees the world. With us today, I think you will get to see some of that surprise, because Kellyanne Conway will take us behind the scenes of the Trump campaign, how they won in 2016, the mistakes that she says were made in 2020, what it meant inside her home, how it's fractured her marriage with George Conway, and what happened when a then New York Times, now Washington Post reporter in Taylor Lorenz literally invaded the direct messages of her 15-year-old daughter. Kellyanne talks about the future of this country generationally. What's the difference between Gen X and Gen Z? She talks about the lasting impression of America First and who is the rightful inheritor from Donald Trump. But not before she says we will see Trump Biden part two. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation with Kellyanne Conway. Kellyanne, I don't normally start with a compliment. It's just not my style. But I'm going to start with telling you my interpretation of you before I met you. I saw you appear on The Daily Show in the last week or two with Trevor Noah. And you said to Trevor, you probably only know me as the caricature that's been painted of me. That's really honestly probably true of what I knew of you as well, Kellyanne. Even though I've sort of been in the world of politics and news media for a long time, I took sort of a 5-year break. And that 5-year break were the years of your most obvious significance in working for Donald Trump. I spent 5 years at ESPN. So when you're in the stream of pop culture just washing over you, all you really get is whatever caricature they paint of you. And then there you are that day in the Fox News green room. And I think I'd even interviewed you on television, but there in the Fox News green room. And I got to tell you, here's the compliment, Kellyanne. I was really extremely impressed. There's just a level of confidence and obvious intelligence, but more than anything, inflappability. I don't know which one is the real word, but you just simply weren't capable of being flustered. Whether or not it was Greg Gutfeld or watching you on CBS. And immediately I said, yeah, this is somebody that I want to have a longer conversation with. This is somebody I want to spend time getting to know.
Just so we're clear, I watched you on ESPN all those years because when I'm on the treadmill or doing housework, I don't listen to the political shows. So,
well, I read in your book, you're a sports nut, in fact. So that's part of the story of how you and your husband, George, got to know each other, because you described yourself as a sports fanatic and he courted you through the prism of sports.
That's true. He was a big Yankees fan. He grew up around Boston, but he said, obviously, he left Boston and moved to New York and took up with the Yankees. And he was, George was trying to court me very sweetly, coming up with these fancy dinner invitations in Washington where I lived. And he'd come down from New York where he was an attorney. And I'd say, oh God, I was in those restaurants all week with clients. I just want to pet my Welsh Corgi and watch these mindless movies and eat ice cream all weekend. You can join me. And then he started to have tickets to the ALCS and the ALDS and the NLCS that year, 1999, and then 2000. Of course, we watched the Yankees win the World Series together. And then I had him promise the same thing, Will, which he thought was a pretty safe promise on his part, which is if the Eagles, my Philadelphia Eagles, ever got to the Super Bowl, we'd have to do that. So we did that in Jacksonville right after our twins were born in 2005. And then we did it again with our 12-year-old twins, or 13 years old by then, four years ago, when they beat Tom Brady and the Patriots with the famous Philly in Minneapolis.
So what do you think it, so Kelly, and let's tie these things together for a minute. So we do share something similar in that I think you've spent much of your life, and you certainly spent many of your years with Donald Trump, being the person that was capable of walking into, in Donald Trump's words, any den. You would walk into CBS or NBC. You'd walk into any hostile interview and come out the other side. Until I joined Fox News, my entire career had been to be surrounded by people who disagree with me. And it was actually something that I enjoyed. I enjoyed being around people that seemed to be on the attack. And I look at back at my life, Kellyanne, and I say, you know, where did that enjoyment come from? My dad was an attorney. We didn't just debate. We argued at the dinner table. I went to law school like you. But I want to know where that came from with you, because you are an attorney as well. You're from Jersey, and you are, I think, in your own description, a bit of a tomboy, going back to your sports fandom. Where did sort of this love of confrontation come from?
It comes from a few things. Number one is I was an only child. I was always taller than the boys and fatter than the girls, as I like to say, until I guess puberty hit and everything worked out for everyone. But I also was a little bit of a loner, even though I grew up in a house of all adult loving women and very close to my two first cousins. So I would line up my stuffed animals and my dolls, and I would make them listen to my opening arguments, my closing arguments. I would be the defense, the prosecutor, they would be the judge, and then I would read the sentencing guidelines. So from the moment I was about 4 years old, people said she really should be an attorney. I'm a fully recovered attorney, 12-step program and everything, but I think that legal background has helped me to form arguments in a logical and rational way rather than an emotional way. I found out the hard way in business, particularly in Washington, D.C., as a young woman starting her own company in my 20s, that there's plenty of room for passion, Will, but there's very little room for emotion, and there's a difference between the two. I also believe that when CNN hired me out of the wilderness in 1996 to be a political analyst, when I was in my 20s, and to be a paid political analyst at a time when that was very rare, I covered both Republican and Democratic conventions, the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire primaries. So when we were in San Diego at the Republican National Convention, I saw a lot of sour, dour faces at CNN. And then we got to the Democratic convention, Bill Clinton's reelection. They were all excited because they were with their friends then. And I thought, wow, is it really that overt? And it was that overt. And it's not even just bias. I think they would maybe pass a lie detector test if you gave them one. They don't even realize that their whole circle of friends and families really doesn't include many people who disagree with them. So to have a differing point of view, not just from the one person next to you on the panel, but really from the anchor, from the producers, from the CEO of the network, from the other three people on the panel, and from the reporters themselves, who should be the unbiased ones at the table, was pretty remarkable. And there were times, Will, I'm sure you felt this way, there were times when I'd say, hold on, there are five of us sitting here, and I'm the only one who has this point of view, so I want half the time. I don't want 20% of the time. I found it didn't work, but I thought it was funny. And last thing, Will, I found early on that the audience is not the anchor or even the other panelists. The audience is the people. There are people watching and listening who need that information, who are hungering for a point of view that matches their own. I think that was the rise of Rush Limbaugh and conservative talk radio. He didn't proselytize people. He made people feel comfortable to come along. And shows like this do the same thing, which is, okay, I'm going to listen to Will Cain, not because he makes me feel right, because he reflects what I already believe and helps me form those arguments a little bit more rationally.
So You said something that resonated with me. So I did spend time at CNN as well as a paid political analyst. And you have mentioned this on some of your appearances. The hard part is not just the timeshare. The hard part is when you are the one lone voice of dissent, what you have to spend your time doing is rejecting the premise, because the premise itself is often already rooted in the bias. So you can't even advance a positive argument because you have to spend your time unwinding the argument that's already spent 80% of the time dedicated in that segment. But here's what you said, and here's how I've changed. And I will tell you, I have changed under the influence of your former boss, Donald Trump. I, like you, want to make an argument based upon logic. And my brain works in the same way, I think, attributable to law school, in a very organized, outlined fashion to make a logical argument. But there is some proverb, Kelly, and I can't remember what it is. It may be a Buddhist proverb. I can't remember, a Far East proverb, about it's easier to turn an elephant by the nose than it is, you know, by some reins attached to his back or something like that. The point of it is the power of emotion, that human beings are swayed by the power of emotion. And Donald Trump clearly, obviously, as well, with your assistant, tapped into some feelings in the American public that had gone unnoticed for a very long time. And I'm not here to say that's a dark art. I'm not here to say that's wrong. What I've learned in the past 5 years is you need to honor and recognize the way people feel, and not everything in life is black and white. So while you and I may see it through a very logical argument, I think in the past 5 years, because of Donald Trump and yourself, I've understood we need to pay more attention to the way people feel.
And Will, that has been the privilege of my professional career. You know, I was a pollster and focus group moderator for decades, and I am again now. And I was the person who literally got on the plane night after night, day after day, and met the American people where they live and learned to listen. Just like good parents have to be great listeners, pollsters and focus group moderators need to be excellent listeners. Give people an opportunity to tell you who they are, what their frustrations are, what their aspirations are. And that has been the gift of my professional career, because unlike some people calling, you know, half the country deplorable and irredeemable, I learned to appreciate and honor the essential wisdom of everyday people. Look, I was raised very modestly, so I also come from a place where I recognize who Donald Trump is speaking to and for, and trying to solve problems on behalf of, when he says forgotten man, forgotten woman, and forgotten child. There's no question about it. And I want to say something else. Donald Trump did something, particularly in the primaries in 2016, Will, that is very difficult for politicians, right, left, and center, to do, which is he kind of superglued himself to a couple of issues that had been mired in single digits in the polling, illegal immigration, trade among them. Nobody was talking about trade because it was, you know, 1% in the polls, maybe, if it were even asked. But he saw trade as a proxy for economic frustration and desperation, for our loss of a manufacturing base, or disrespect for coal workers or miners or construction workers. And he would say, China's eating our lunch. We have to recalibrate and make fair and reciprocal and modernize these trade deals with countries like Mexico and Canada, China, Korea, Japan. And he did exactly that. So I think he tapped into also emotion. It wasn't just fear. It was also this frustration. And he, as a political outsider, had an identity with most Americans who also consider themselves political outsiders.
Yeah, and illegal immigration, you pointed to that one, I think is the best proxy. Trade as well. And I've said, honestly, on this podcast, I've talked with the audience about this. I have evolved on trade. I have evolved from sort of a libertarian, free market, pure capitalism mindset, a rising tide lifts all boats and cheaper products are good, into the idea that we need to use tariffs as a way, yes, to protect on national security, but also to protect jobs here at home and dignity and productivity when it comes to the worker. You know, what is it, back to illegal immigration, the lesson after Mitt Romney lost, Kellyanne, was that Republicans needed to pivot to a softer stance on illegal immigration. And to me, that's the one that Donald Trump said, no, you're wrong, and won over the country with that particular issue.
He truly did. We did some polling in the summer of 2014 and released it at the Heritage Foundation. It got a ton of coverage. And one thing that we said there was that Americans look at immigration also as an economic issue. It's an issue of fairness, national security and sovereignty, but it's also an economic issue where people felt it was pretty arrogant for folks like Michael Bloomberg, then the mayor of New York City and others to say, well, illegal immigrants are here to do the jobs Americans just won't do. Guess what? Your ancestors and my ancestors came here and probably did the jobs that are being described. You do what you have to do to support yourself and your family. And so the other thing I wrote about is that Americans are hankering for a, quote, America first immigration policy. And all I meant by that was just as Macron may want a France first or Germany may want a Germany first policy. We want an American first policy, which means that we're a sovereign nation that has enforceable physical borders. And that we also make sure that Americans who want to compete for these available jobs can compete. They're not going to take $7 under the table an hour and feel that they're being honored. So we need to raise the wages. Also, in the matter of illegal immigration, it really was about border security for President Trump also, and it was about the drugs. And I'm very happy to tell you that under President Trump, along with First Lady Melania Trump, the big public policy issue they worked on together was the opioid and poly drug crisis. Overdose deaths declined, Will, for the first time in 30 years. Now they're over 107,000 again. You can fill up two Dodger stadiums and still have people looking for seats. If I'm approximating the deaths, they're not even touching this issue.
Right.
In San Francisco, where you may have a DA recalled today, he prosecuted zero fentanyl cases last year, even though more people died of drug overdoses in San Francisco than of COVID. So I think you're seeing what happens when policies get unraveled and discontinued out of spite. And that people, I think, like Biden and Harris, are not really responding to what the American people are saying. Donald Trump was able to tap into that.
How much of Donald Trump's positioning, Kellyanne, is intuitive versus data driven? And I say that not because in acknowledging that question, it could be, in a way, pitting you against Donald Trump because you're the data driven pollster telling you where the American people stand today. So, of course, you're incentivized to take credit for that. However, we both know that also he took some of those positions before you came on board. So, you know, with illegal immigration or tariffs. And I'm just curious, when he is formulating these positions, and we should talk more about what these positions entail and what is America first, but in formulating these positions, was Donald Trump, is he driven by instinct, or is he actually poring over data on where the American public's mind is focused?
It's actually, well, option C, both of the above, but he's an incredibly intuitive, instinctive person. And people say, oh, he's governing by his gut. Excuse me. He is elevating issues into the public consciousness based on his instinct and his gut. But it's also a learned situation over time where he was, people don't look at Donald Trump as patient. He's very patient. He waited for the right year to run for president. He had thought about it in the past. But by the time 2016 had rolled around, things had gotten so bad with other countries stealing our jobs, stealing our wealth, stealing our technology, and putting us behind. You know, America was no longer number one in so many ways. And he was able to fill that gap and leverage that. But he does have unbelievable instincts. He also has an incredible memory. He never forgets people and things, even ones you might want him to forget. And then I think he looks at the data. I know he looks at the data to see, you know, how is it that people will understand it the best? So you can take one big issue like the economy, but what is that to people? Is it a tax cut? Is it deregulation? Is it energy independence? Is it a matter of making NATO countries pay more of their fair share to the common defense? Is it trade deals? Is it bringing back our manufacturing base? All of those that I just said, gas prices, grocery store, infant formula, those are all economic concerns, but they're also more gut concerns. People are now trying to afford everyday necessities, not just even luxuries. And so he's an incredibly instinctive person. And I think too many people, the way I describe Donald Trump in my politics and in life is the following. He's a complicated person with simple ideas. Build the wall, cut your taxes, repeal, replace Obamacare. And I think most people in politics are the opposite. They're very simple people. Putting forth these unbelievably complicated ideas that sound like Washington gobbledygook and are too, you know, are a little too labyrinth, if not Byzantine, for the average American to understand or want to follow.
Let's stay on your expertise. I want to stay on polling for just a moment. How then did everyone get it wrong outside of course, whatever internal polling you had within the Trump campaign? How did every other polling, and I believe it's every one of them, right, Kellyanne? I mean, from 538 to all of your mainstream media internal yes. polls, every one of them got it wrong on Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. Why?
Yes. Several reasons, and I write extensively about this in the book, Will. First, to just record history, and second, directionally in moving forward. In other words, how what happened in 2016 can happen again. And a couple reasons. Number one is they do too many national polls. When I took over as campaign manager, as a pollster, I knew national polls are meaningless. They'll tell you a little bit about the trends, but they're meaningless because there are 10, 12 states that are truly swing states. And in 2016, we focused on those states, and then we focused on 64 counties, and by the end, it was closer to 36 counties. I remember being on a phone call with ABC News's political team, and John Carl said, can you send me a copy of those 36 counties? This was Sunday before Tuesday election day, and I said, I'll send them to you on Wednesday after we win. You know, you can hear the laughter erupting. We were polling extensively in the states. And what we saw was some of the messages, for example, that had helped Donald Trump secure Ohio and Iowa with comfortable leads. Those same messages were now resonating in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So we took him and Pence and those messages and went to the upper Midwest and the Rust Belt states. The other thing that Donald Trump did a great job, and when I asked him, when he asked me to be campaign manager, Will, I asked him, look, Mr. Trump, the blue wall is real. Hillary Clinton benefits from the blue wall. She only needs a few extra seats to win this thing. If you give me permission to put aside electability and focus on electoral college, electability pretends that I know who can and can't win. And electoral college is how you do or don't win the presidency. He agreed to it immediately. And when I told him about the blue wall, and this is important for your listeners, in my view, moving forward, the blue wall, I said, let's do the following. Let's focus on the 10 or 11 states that Obama Biden carried twice with over 50% of the vote, where Hillary's never been at 50% in the polls and stayed there recently. And third point, most importantly, Will, where Republican had won statewide for Senate and or governor
right.
during the Obama years. So these are not states allergic to Republican leadership. And that left us with Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Iowa, North Carolina, Florida, even states that we didn't win, like Nevada, New Hampshire, and Colorado. But they fit that definition. And you know, Donald Trump agreed to it immediately, whereas the Romney people never listened. The McCain people couldn't be bothered. We see what happened to their races. But here's the other thing about the polls. I think people all ask the wrong questions. So the science is off in that they pretend the likely voter model can't possibly include people who are first-time voters or lapsed voters who are coming back into the fold, or people who don't look like Republican voters who were Trump voters, some women, some young people, some Hispanics and African Americans, some immigrants, certainly some younger people, none of which went for a majority for Donald Trump, but he won enough of them on the margins in these swing counties, in these important states, that it made the difference. And that was particularly true of union households in those union-rich states I was just mentioning to you.
Those voters, Kellyanne, let's focus in on union voters, but also I think all the entire class of voters that switched from essentially being Democrats or first-time voters to Donald Trump voters. In your estimation going forward, will they be in significant percentages Republican voters, or are they today particularly and exclusively attached to Donald Trump?
Not exclusively, but heavily attached to Donald Trump, and really attached to the America First agenda. And that America First agenda is one that they think that they believe brought them into economic better times. And, you know, well, this is America. We love to say we're optimistic, we're resilient, we're hopeful things will get better. But a lot of those voters you just mentioned, the union voters who switched to Donald Trump in 2016, many of whom stayed with him in 2020, some of whom did not, they are not saying it will get better. They are saying it was so much better not that long ago. And how do I get back to that? They can't get a positive economic message or see Biden as a man with a plan when it comes to rescuing us from this malaise, this economic malaise. And so for them, they demand that their candidates be an America First candidate, particularly on energy and the economy. That, of course, begins with Donald Trump. If he says no to a run in 2024, they will be looking at the candidate that is most confidently, competently, and credibly the America First candidate.
Don't go anywhere. More of the Will Cain podcast right after this. Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
Okay, this is a conversation I want to dig into a little bit deeper. But first, one more look back, okay? And for the sake of our conversation, here's the thing. I think there are many irregularities and improprieties when it comes to what happened in 2020, most notably from what happened on the side of the media. But to the extent that you can look at this as lesson learned, what group of people, maybe those you just described, because you said not all of them stayed with Donald Trump in 2020. What group of people did Donald Trump lose in 2020, in your estimation, that affected the outcome of the election? We hear so much about suburban women, but what group is it where the election swung?
There are several groups, and in some of those counties, they swung right back to Biden. They had been Democratic counties for a while. I'm thinking of a few in Pennsylvania, for example, where there was massive impropriety and irregularities with the election. But I would say it's a combination of self-identified independents who rejected Hillary Clinton. Again, maybe not a majority, but enough. Rejected Hillary Clinton because independents, by their very definition, don't like Republicans or Democrats. They don't like Washington. They don't like the swamp. They don't like people who've been in office forever. So they went with the political outsider, the independent businessman. And then for some of them, Will, unfathomably, they went to Joe Biden, who is the Loch Ness monster of the swamp. And they went to him for many other reasons. But when you look at suburban women, I mean, we did very well among women when we were running against Hillary Clinton, the queen bee. Remember, women were a majority of the electorate in 2016, and we denied Hillary becoming the first female president. Why? Well, because you have to message to women the way you message to everyone else and know that they will hear you through their own lens. And I think that in 2020, when I heard, I don't know who gave him this advice, but when President Trump would go up to the podium at these different rallies, and he was reduced to the number of rallies he could do because of COVID, certainly that hurt as well. But he would go up in the rallies, go up to the podium and say, "Suburban housewives, this one's for you." And then he would say, "I'm not going to have people moving into your neighborhoods." And I'm like, who told him to say that? When in 2016, I was talking about the fact that one of the biggest lies ever told by a U.S. president to her citizenry was you can keep your plan, keep your doctor. Everyone will have health insurance. And here we are many years later, and so many Americans don't have it. Obamacare is failing in the exchanges, et cetera. We talk to women, not just from the waist down the way the left does. We talk to them from the waist up, because after all, that's where our eyes, ears, hearts, mouths, and minds are. Right. So I think it's the independents, some of those union households. And actually, President Trump did better among non-college educated women the first time than the second time, I believe, and that hurt too.
So, in fact, I think this is fair to say as well. I read in the book that you told President Trump in 2016 that the ballot cannot be Trump or not Trump. In fact, you want the public's mind more focused on who is Hillary. I think it's fair to say in 2020, for many people, the election came down to Trump versus not Trump. It wasn't so much Absolutely. A reflection of how people felt about Joe Biden. So let's talk more, though, about the future. You said those voters signed up, yes, primarily for Donald Trump as an individual, but even as a backstop, I guess, for the America First agenda. What do you think? Define. Here's what I've said. And listen, I'll tell you my personal story, Kellyanne, and it's not going to be unique from yours. I was not a fan of Donald Trump in the early 2010s. So 10, 11, 12, 13. I did not. And I have said this, and I would tell the former president this when we meet, and we will meet. I did not vote for Donald Trump in 2016. That does not mean I voted for Hillary. In fact, it definitely does not mean I voted for Hillary. But by 2020, Donald Trump had won me over, and he had won me over by the America First agenda. In your estimation, what is that agenda?
The America First agenda is exactly that whether it comes to national security, funding our military, making sure law enforcement, military, border protection have deeper respect and more generous resources to do their jobs to keep us all safe. The America First agenda means energy independence and the tens of thousands of jobs here in the U.S. that go with that, and the ability to be, as we were under President Trump for the first time ever, a net producer of natural gas and oil. So we're exporting it, including to those Eastern European countries that used to be supplied by Russia, like Poland. America First also means that when the president of the United States goes abroad, he doesn't apologize for America or denigrate America the way Biden and Harris really have in the last few months. It means that he stands up for America and says, I am here fighting for American interests. If we can collaborate on trade deals, we can collaborate on NATO, on you know, protection of different areas of the globe, we will do that. America is a very generous country that way, but America will come first. It also means that we have real border security. And it means that we have an economy that lifts up job seekers, job creators, and important one, the majority of American households, job holders. It means that regulation is reduced. And President Trump said many times, including in his first 2 years, Will, that he thought even better than the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which was tremendous in creating growth and giving relief to employers and employees. He said he thought his deregulatory agenda was even more important in terms of lifting up so many businesses and so many individuals and property owners. And he's probably got a point there, because he wanted to do two regulations out for every new one in. And it was more like 8-1 the first couple of years. It also means that when American children want an education that is worthy of their dignity and their humanity, they are not stuck in failing schools because of their zip code. We believe every child is worthy of an education that prepares them for the rest of their life and is worthy of their dignity.
And in my estimation, Kellyanne, to boil that down, what resonated with me is that we should walk around with pride in being Americans, not just in our history, but in our character of who we are today. We don't always need to see ourselves through the apologetic lens that we are somehow inherently flawed and uniquely evil in the world. And then by an extension, when it comes to creating modern day policy, it's not only okay, but we should place the interests of Americans over those who come from other nations. It doesn't mean we're not empathetic and we don't want to help, but not at the cost of Americans. And that's what I said. I traveled the path that you did, Kellyanne. I believe you were with Senator Cruz before.
I ran one of his super PACs, yes.
Yeah. And so like a lot of us, I said, I traveled the path towards Trump. A lot of us traveled this path. And for me, it really was about this repositioning of what it is to be a conservative.
Yes, indeed. And look, people say, oh, it's populism. It's not really conservatism. It's Trump's a personality cult. I think it's a policy cult. It's not a cult at all, but it really is. It's actually based on policy. And in this case, results. And so Donald Trump did not erect a conventional political campaign. He built a movement, and people felt that they were a part of that movement. Well, for free. It's why they stood in the rain or the blaring heat for days on end just to go to a rally. And I remember the media saying to me at the time, I know, Kellyanne, we see all the people, but will they vote? No, they stood in the rain for overnight on a lawn chair, but they're not going to vote. Of course they voted. And I want to get back to something you hit on, because a lot of the people interviewing me generally and about my book don't do it. And this is important for the future as well. Do you know, Will, after the 2016 election and after the 2020 election, this group of Democratic pollsters, some of whom are my friends, all of whom I know, they apologized both times. Even though we had different results in 16 and 20 presidentially, they apologized both times. They said both times we underestimated the Trump voter. There's a reason for that. We never deeply examine that which we deeply disdain. And people, you know, the professionals are not paying attention to who these are. They act like they're just going to vanish. Or if we could just get rid of Donald Trump, we can get rid of the voters. That's not true. First of all, you can't get rid of Donald Trump. You can't get rid of his voters. And why would you? But they still don't get it. And I hear that when I see the dripping with sarcasm, the elitism, just the outright snobbery about some of these Trump voters coming from people whose job it is to go get the story, not to get the president.
You know, Kellyanne, just going to take me back to what I said to you earlier about the logic versus emotion tension. When I said that, that isn't meant to suggest that the arguments and policies of America First or Donald Trump aren't logical. But what it is it's a rebuttal to what you just described. Those years that I spent at CNN, it was less when you walked the hallways or you sat on sets, what you heard from people was less a meeting of the minds of where the American public is, but more of a dictation of where the American public should be. So it's constantly a talking down to the American public, thinking they are not worthy of their own thoughts, thinking that they are stupid, and thinking that your own logic, therefore, should rule the world. And this is, if you want to call it populism, fine. But it's being more in touch with the, you know, the democratic, which we hear democracy constantly invoked as a religious proposition. This is more in touch with the democratic electorate out there. Really quickly, on America First, so looking ahead, 2024, who do you think is an authentic, and I think that's the key word here, Kellyanne, authentic inheritor of that agenda? If it is not Donald Trump in 2024, and maybe it will be, and you should tell us. I know you talked to the president, but if it is not Donald Trump, who is an authentic inheritor of America First?
Well, first and foremost, it is Donald Trump. And forget about all the polls when they're asking, who do you want to be president or who would you vote for? That's all nonsense, going back to what I said in 2016 to him, which is, you know, the horse race question is the one everybody wants to know. It's the least relevant because it's the one most apt to change over time. So Donald Trump is the founder of the America First movement. Obviously, those policies and beliefs belong to the people. So it's first and foremost Donald Trump. And then I think it's someone who Donald Trump says is a legitimate, incredible inheritor of America First. These were the Trump-Pence accomplishments. Even if there are people in MAGA upset with the former vice president, those are the Trump-Pence accomplishments, and you can't take that away. They had a great working relationship for 4 years, minus a couple of days. I think Mike Pompeo also. I know other people like staffers try to take credit for the amazing gains that were forged mainly by the Secretary of State and the president, of course. And then, of course, you've got some of these amazing governors doing fabulous work. I know people talk about Ron DeSantis, obviously. I think Kim Reynolds out in Iowa has done amazing work. It just goes on and on. We've got people in the Senate. So I actually think that the Republican bench is so full, but it's still led by, still coached and managed and led by Donald J. Trump. But the Democratic bench looks terribly thin. And I think in part because they're not really making the pivot to where the people are. Look at the polls right now, Will, especially the media polls being conducted by NBC, Politico, CBS, CNN, all these outlets that worked overtime to help Joe Biden get elected. Their polls are the most searing indictment of what happens when our leaders, in this case, Biden, Harris, and Democrats, don't listen, don't heed the will of the people. So I think it's an embarrassing riches, but I also think it's important to not focus on personalities, to focus on the principles of America First. I think it's important to focus on policies, not politics.
Okay.
For a while, so that people understand, because you know what? People are hurting right now. They're desperate to get out of this economic malaise. But no, I think that people are going to, this is the modern Republican Party. And by the way, it's not just Democrats and Democratic consultants who are snobs or media. It's a lot of these never Trumpers. You know, roughly 5 to 7% of the Republican Party and 95% of the people on CNN and MSNBC, like you said, who are Republican, there's a certain snobbery there. And if you go back and you watch the Romney campaign, how arrogantly they predicted he would win. He won North Carolina. He won one single swing state. We won like 10 or 11. So the point is, I don't think that was like a top-down campaign also that really didn't understand people. And whoever is moving forward, as long as you take the people along with you and you're listening to them and not you're speaking to them and not at them, that person will do very well.
Will Donald Trump run for president?
I believe he will. He feels there's unfinished business. He loves his country. He's one of the majority of Americans who tells pollsters that Harris Biden just they don't have what it takes. They just can't do it. Neither one of them. I mean, Harris basically has a part time no show job as vice president. We don't even see her, which might be for the better. But it's maddening all the same. I mean, people aren't. I keep reading, the angry voter. People aren't angry. They're frustrated and they're exasperated in some ways, and they're a little bit worried. The president would like to run. And I believe his best, clearest, cleanest path to being president again is not to look backward, is to look forward and just run as a rematch against Joe Biden. Many of the polls say right now he would beat him.
It takes a Jersey girl. It takes a Jersey girl to invoke the union mafia no show job analogy. And it takes a Soprano fan to recognize it right off the bat. If Donald Trump runs for president, do you expect, I have heard from people behind the scenes that they do. Do you expect a crowded Republican primary field, or would they clear the way for Donald Trump?
It's funny, the people that you think may want to run probably would not run. So people say, oh, Ron DeSantis will run against him. I don't know if that's true. I mean, Governor DeSantis can do what he wants, but he's up for his own reelection now. He got less than 50% of the vote the first time. He's going to kill it this time. He's raised $100 million. He's been an incredible governor for Florida. He's also a very young man. Who knows, he owes, you know, a lot of that political resurgence at the end to President Trump's endorsement. He's got a long way to go. Very smart person who doesn't speak ill of the president, which is good. And so, look, I think where people will run is in the Never Trump lane. And they think it's a really big lane. It's more like a bike path. And it's already crowded with people who think I'm going to be the alternative to Donald Trump. We need to, quote, move on from Donald Trump. But there again, they're not listening to the people
right,
who aren't ready to move on from Trump and his policies.
I want to lean, by the way, Kellyanne, I want to save some time because I do want to talk about your personal life, which you lay out in the book, and it is fascinating. But also, I want to keep leaning on your expertise for just one more moment. I don't see a path for a success for, as you mentioned, the failing Biden-Harris administration. But what will the Democrats do in 2024? They don't seem to have, as you pointed out, much of a bench, many alternatives to turn to. So let's assume for a moment that it were Donald Trump running in 2024. Who's he running against?
Well, I think it will be Biden because the people like Buttigieg, I mean, he ruined himself by going into this administration and speaking foolishly about things like the Green New Deal and telling us all to drive electric cars. And this is, you know, someone who speaks eight languages, but none of which makes sense when he's, you know, talking about these matters. So I think it will be Biden. I mean, this is Biden's wish fulfillment. He may be the only person out there, Will, who doesn't know he's failing. Maybe the people around him aren't telling him that and being honest with him. And I feel that the Biden people would love to run against Trump because they feel they beat him once, they'll beat him again. Folks won't do that. He's their greatest foil. And President Trump not being on Twitter and not being as visible and vocal, especially in the first year of the Biden administration, really hurt the Biden administration because they're so used to having Donald Trump as their foil that people are saying, listen, man up and own and eat these terrible policies and decisions you've made, including, if not especially, the Afghanistan
right,
pullout, which is still very vexing and angering to many Americans. So it probably will be Biden-Harris. I think Harris gives Biden a lot of job protection because people are very worried he can't do it. But look, I think they'll be primaried from the left. I think they've got real problems in 2024 as a sitting president, more so than Trump would have, because Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, AOC, they're primarying the Biden endorsed candidates now in the midterms. Biden just suffered a grievous loss in Oregon. Congressman Kurt Schrader lost to the socialist endorsed, you know, Sanders, AOC, somebody endorsed insurgent. And so I think he's going to be primaried from the left, and all the nonsense of trying to mollify the radicals and the hard left at the beginning of his administration before Afghanistan and even now, that will have paid no dividends for Joe Biden.
Okay, I want to ask you about your personal life, and I'll caveat this with, I think I've seen all of your interviews, and I've talked to you personally on set and in the green rooms at Fox News, and I've read your book. So I've heard your answer to many of these questions. Here's what I want to ask you. Every marriage is difficult, Kellyanne. Every marriage has its own highway full of potholes. And in our line of work, I think a complicating factor, not that you and I are in the same line of work, but in the public eye, you have the complicating factor of dealing with a barrage of negativity on a constant basis from strangers. I know that for me, a refuge in that is having a teammate at home who is pretty yes, much always on my side. She is there for me, right? When the world is tweeting or saying or whatever, you know, Will, you're a racist, whatever it may be. There's somebody that you come home to that knows who you are. It seems from the outset, and I know you're right, you have deep love for George. And anybody who is listening to this who hasn't read the book or isn't familiar with Kellyanne and George's story, of course, George is a huge critic of President Trump. And you write that in the sunroom or in the reading room in your home, you would feel there's somebody actively plotting against you. So I want to know, what's that like, you know, from a human perspective, from a marriage perspective, which most of us listening can identify with, of not having that refuge or that partner at home who knows you for who you are, instead feeling the opposite, feeling like, at least professionally, you have an enemy in the house.
Yes, the loss of all of that, of George as my person, of George as my fellow traveler and supporter of Donald Trump. I mean, here's a man who was crying in his black MAGA hat on election night, very proud of Donald Trump's victory, of his wife's victory, and like me, accepted a big job in the Trump administration. And people need to know that. They just need to know the facts before they judge. Because George, you know, has now become like this social media superstar of all the, I call them the wine non-moms, weirdos all, you know, who want to lavish him with affection and attention for whatever anti-Trump or pro-Corgi tweet he has sent out that day. I don't choose to live my life online, even partly or mostly. I think it's a very toxic place. And gee, living offline, it just smells and looks and tastes and just is better. So that's where I choose to live. But yes, you're right. I lost my person. I lost my refuge. And George is not just my refuge from the hate and from the doubt. He was my refuge from people like George, who were so gratuitously and ferociously and viciously critical of the president or of the people who worked for the president. And the irony is I always worried about our children reading all that. And now they can include, they can read it, including from their own father. So it's been incredibly sad. And just for the record, George doesn't owe his loyalty to Donald Trump or the Republican Party, but he owes his loyalty to me. And right. He supported me. You know, Will, George didn't just urge me to take the job as campaign manager, job as senior counselor, move our family to Washington, which meant 4 school-age children would have to switch their schools. He insisted that I take my shot, and we moved to Washington, D.C. as a family. We did that together. He changed his mind, not as immediate as he says he did, because the record shows and my book lays out in factual detail, George enjoyed many, many of the privileges and perks of the White House, including a private dinner with Donald and Melania Trump a whole year into the administration. And then we had dinner with Jared and Ivanka Kushner at their home, which is near our home in D.C., 14 months later. In other words, so I never thought it was going to be as bad as it got. And I certainly wasn't prepared for the cult of George Conway. But I also point out in the book that it was unusual for a man married to a conservative woman to be known as her husband. So he's known as Kellyanne Conway's husband in most of the chatter on cable news and the networks even and in print. And so that's unusual. We know right. Hillary Clinton because she was Bill Clinton's wife, first and foremost. So it's very unusual. But, you know, Will, back to what you said at the very beginning, let me knit it all together here. Don't forget, the media did not just want Donald Trump to not be president, did not just vote against him, but they were shocked and embarrassed when he actually won in 2016. Mm-hmm. They were completely shocked and embarrassed. These are egos that got their hat handed them. Their polling was all wrong. And so they, you know, they saw in George the quickest way to try to get to me also.
How does it survive?
Way, you know, small children. Pardon?
How does it survive, Kellyanne? I mean, how does a marriage survive that? I'm a big believer, by the way, that your politics are only a small slice of who you are. Human beings are much deeper than our politics. We have ways of bonding over sports and every other aspect of life. So politics shouldn't define you. But clearly yours is a unique situation where personal life, professional life, and politics are also intermingled. How does a marriage survive? Has it survived?
I write in the book toward the end, my book, Here's the Deal, which I hope that your viewers and listeners buy. Here's the Deal on sale now. Great Father's Day gift, everyone, for the men in your life. I write in my book that democracy will survive, America will survive, but I fear that George and I may not survive. And it's very sad to write those words on paper, but it's a much more mature and rational and responsible way for the mother of these 4 children to express it than just to sit on social media all day screaming into the wind, you know, spitting into the wind. And I'm sad about it because I think it's a matter of how we spend our time. I stepped away from my job, very famously said, less drama, more mama for my kids. They were going to start their second school year online, which was completely incomprehensible. But I told the president, they need me. He said, oh, no, just go. Just come in when you can. I said, I can't do that, Mr. President. George said he was stepping away from the Lincoln Project. He said he was stepping away from Twitter. He did that, but just briefly. And I, you know, yes, I'm working and I wrote my book, et cetera, but I made good on my promise to my children. And I, you know, I also was raised in a household where you don't speak publicly. And George very much was never this way. You don't speak publicly about personal things. So it was very jarring to me, but I had to set something straight in the book because people are talking about my marriage on national TV. Normally, you know, typically the people talking about my marriage, Will, have you seen these people? Terrified, troubled, thin-skinned, people living in glass houses all talking about my marriage. And then, of course, my children, which was beyond the pale.
Don't go anywhere. More of the Will Cain podcast right after this.
Let's go straight there, Kellyanne. Let's talk about your children. I know you're super and rightfully passionate about this. Claudia shared, your daughter Claudia, some of her thoughts on TikTok, on social media, when it came to President Trump. And this, in her estimation, gave Taylor Lorenz of the Washington Post the green light to not just invade your family, which we've been discussing with you and George, but your children. And I know this is something you have a lot to say about.
Yeah. Taylor Lorenz is at the New York Times at the time. Now she's at the Washington Post and is under fire as we speak. She was just, there were just two or three corrections over the weekend in one story she wrote. She is not a reputable journalist. She's not a journalist at all, really. She's a showboat. There are many of them. But here is a woman who's 35 years old at the time, direct messaging our 15-year-old daughter and promising her what every 15-year-old loves, fame, fortune, exposure, likes, followers. And that allowed many other people to do the same to our 15-year-old daughter, never once trying to contact her easy-to-reach parents. And you know what my immediate reaction was, Will, I write in the book? Sheer terror. I was terrified for the safety of my daughter. And she was down the shore with some friends, and George was there with her. We had just switched. Claudia had some friends at the shore, and I was there with them, and then George and I switched. She had a different group of friends come in. I was terrified because people can now find her. And I feel this reprehensible Taylor Lorenz, who's now, you know, crying her eyes out as a 38-year-old woman with no kids of her own, who is, and Claudia's not the only one. She makes it a practice to go and try to ruin other people and other kids. And she's been trouble everywhere she's gone. Her colleagues at the New York Times and the Washington Post privately cannot stand her. Don't know why she's there. Don't know even know what this beat is. And they're embarrassed that they constantly have to have corrections and she makes everything about her. But make no mistake, as goes my family, I mean, Claudia Conway, beautiful, brilliant, as is her twin brother, two younger sisters. She's, you know, she's amazing. She's, we're very close, thank God. But she did what Taylor Lorenz and frankly, George can't do, which is step away from all that social media attention, affection, this parallel universe of nothingness that is a sugar high. Who cares what a bunch of strangers think negatively or positively? I don't read the criticism. I don't read the praise because I don't need a big ego and I don't need to be crying under the table. How is this real? And so I give her a ton of credit. And we need standards, Will. The New York Times, the entire email exchange with the New York Times editors is in my book. Here's the deal. Go read it, everybody, because I lay out the exchange that George and I both had. We were of a single mind and he stepped up and stepped in, thank God. And the New York Times editors really couldn't care less. Like, oh, we'd love to talk more to your family about what? And then, of course, the standards editor and somebody from the top said, oh, we're not going to write about this anymore. Well, you know what? And people thought it was okay to surface a 15-year-old. I always treated the Obama girls, Chelsea Clinton, the Bush girls with respect, but also like Fabergé eggs. You just don't do that. Will, there's an unspoken compact that civilized people have. You don't reach out to other people's kids. Right. You don't put upon other people's kids.
It's despicable. And I think the analogy you've drawn several times, which is apropos, which is if Taylor Lorenz had been a 35-year-old man contacting a minor 15 years old in her DMs of her social media, how would we as a nation feel about that? But because it's Taylor Lorenz, somehow it's forgivable. Hey, on the note of you bring up your kids and then now let's tie together your expertise in polling. I saw you describe yourself, or maybe it was Wikipedia that said at one time you described yourself as a Gen X conservative or a Gen X Republican. I'm Gen X. I'm fascinated by generations, you know, Gen X, millennial, yes, wherever we are, Gen Z, and what their mindset is on the country, on the outlook, on their own individuality. You know, I don't know if you've done much research on this in your polling, but what do you think about where we are as generational divides? I mean, this sort of seems like it's Gen X's time. I think DeSantis is a Gen Xer. Ted Cruz is a Gen Xer. You start to think
1965 to 1978. So
yeah,
yes.
And Gen X really hasn't taken the mantle of leadership in the way the baby boomers have held on to for quite some time. Do we just skip Gen X? Does the millennial generation just step into the leadership void? I'm just kind of fascinated by generational politics and your knowledge of polling within.
No, you're right. This is the time for Gen X. I mean, people, the baby boomer generation, the millennial generation, that bookend generation X, Will, are so much larger generation is, I like to call us a generation for generation formerly known as X, meaning X is sort of this blank, is sort of this variable to be determined. And now we're defining ourselves much more. We are in these leadership positions. I think the older members of the generation, which includes me, some of us, particularly the women, we forewent marriage and motherhood till later on. We were focused on our careers. Some forewent it altogether, decided not to get married and or have children, one or the other. And so I think for us now, we are in these positions of leadership, of stewardship, of mentorship, and we're going to have, I mean, we've gone the other way right now, but we're going to have a couple of Gen X presidents coming up, I think, in the next decade or two, certainly. And it's not just political leadership. I mean, when I poll Generation X, when we did years ago, and the millennials feel the same way, Will, we ask, would you rather be president of the country or president of your own company? It's not even close. People would much prefer to be president of their own company than president of the country. But, you know, Gen Z is the one I worry about a great deal, because these 13 to 24 year olds in all the polling pretty much say the same thing. And that's obviously a wide swath, 13 to 24. But the older and the younger say the same thing. Post pandemic, they feel that mental health has been compromised. Their ability to form and retain platonic and genuine, healthy relationships with members of the opposite sex or the same sex have real or adults in their lives, like teachers or counselors, have been stunted, if not ruined. The lost learning, they're very worried about their careers and education levels. They're very worried about, I call it life interrupted, the kids are not all right. You know what Gen Z is worried about? Not being able to enjoy the fruits of a successful society on the same time frame that maybe the rest of us have. Own your own home, get down your debt, your student loans, et cetera. They feel like all that has been interrupted. So I have to keep an eye on them. They're going to be relying upon Generation X to lead the way.
Well, real quick on this. So I would assume, and you have the data on this, but Gen X and probably even millennials are inherently distrustful of institutions. They've Yes. lived through a ton of corruption when it comes to institutions. But it seems that Gen Z places more faith in the concept of institutions. This is a generation that seems to be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, much more open to the idea of censorship, as though there's somebody out there who we can trust to actually control that lever or whatever it may be, vaccines or healthcare in general. It seems that the younger generation is more trusting of things that institutions that Generation X would have been distrustful.
They're much more geared toward collectivism, and that's for sure. And so it's much easier for them to come together of one, you know, one mindset on particular issues that maybe we didn't even grapple with or consider when we were their ages. I was at a friend's daughter's bat mitzvah over the weekend, and she said from the Bima, she said, you know, to her daughter, your father and I are amazed how you, 13, process concepts that make sense to you and your generation. It was a really smart way of saying it. So I look at them as much more collective. You saw them out in force after the George Floyd murder at the protest. You see them. You see them much more engaged with technology, which is their native tongue, in terms of what is right and what is wrong policy-wise. Of course, there could be another point of view. So I think for them, it's because technology is their native tongue. They're far less skeptical of censorship and tech overlords than maybe we would be, because we remember the land before time. And we see what happens when one point of view is diminished or denied or extinguished. I mean, look at this. The New Zealand Prime Minister at Harvard University commencement this weekend. Go and pull it up. It's kowtowing to secularism completely. She's telling us every great thing they've done in New Zealand, and everybody's like, yay. And there may be people in the audience who don't agree that climate justice is the number one issue. They think inflation is, or they think national security is, or border security. And the idea that you can't have that point of view. So I would say maybe censorship, but really collectivism is right. Something I think Generation X was much more individualized. Roughly 35 or 40% of Generation X had lived in a single parent household at some point before their 18th birthdays. I'd read that years ago. I think it's a little bit different for this generation. I think the last thing I'll say about Gen Z, unfortunately, we're treating too many kids in this country like they're already adults, and treating too many adults like they're still kids. And I worry about Gen Z that way. I think we should give them a little bit of space to be, you know, the non-adults they are.
I don't know if you know this, but there are videos, you're fairly unplugged, you said, but there are videos on YouTube talking about how Kellyanne Conway answers a question.
I've never seen that, no.
Oh, yeah. They break down your style, you know, to use a word that somebody just asked you in the question, so it seems like you're addressing the question directly, but then going in whatever direction you want. But I will say this. I've appreciated the way we've had this conversation today. Not that this was a hostile interview, but I feel like you addressed everything that I brought up. And I could keep going, by the way. I have many, many things I'd love to talk to you about. Maybe we will again. But I've appreciated this, and I've appreciated getting to know you the little bit that I have the last couple of weeks, because you're not the caricature that the mainstream media has portrayed of you. You're incredibly confident and smart, and that's true, and unflappable, by the way. But here's the deal. Go check it out. It's out right now, and you'll get to know the person, not the caricature of Kellyanne Conway. Thank you, Kellyanne.
Will Cain, thanks so much for having me. All the best to you. Take care.
There you go. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. As always, I hope you will go to Apple or Spotify. Leave 5 stars if you think that it's worth it. Share this podcast with your friends. On YouTube, you can send each other links. You can leave a comment. You can email this podcast, text this podcast, direct message this podcast to your friends. I'll see you again next time.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.